What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded at TBRCon 2023. TBRCon is an all-virtual sci-fi, fantasy, and horror convention that I directed and organized and was founded by David Walters of FanFi Addict. And this year we had the pleasure of hosting 30 author panels, which were absolutely amazing, and I highly recommend checking them out. But since so many of you listen to podcasts and prefer that over watching things on YouTube, I have published this live author panel here on the SFF Addicts podcast feed. I'll be releasing a new author panel every Friday until they run out. So until then, sit back and enjoy this week's TBRCon 2023 author panel. Enjoy.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, from wherever it is you're tuning in on the third rock from the sun. This is the panel, Hope Punk and Optimistic Futures. My name is Jonathan Nevers. I'm the author of the space opera series Wind Tide and the recently released spy-fi space opera Stellar Instinct. And I am thrilled to welcome these four authors today to talk with us about positivism, hope, kindness in speculative fiction, get into some details about this subgenre known as hope punk, and also just talk generally about the craft of writing and celebrate positive futures. So we're going to jump right in by going around and just have each of them introduce themselves. If each of you could just introduce yourself and tell us just a little bit about what you do in terms of writing, and we'll then dive in from there and really dig into some of the particulars. So I'm going to start by asking Kat, if you would please go first.
Okay. Hi, I'm Kat Rambo. I write a lot of short stories, and I also do some novels. Most recently, I'm working on a space opera series, first of which is You Sexy Thing, and the sequel of which is coming out this year, finally. Title is Devil's Gun.
Ooh. Wonderful. Serena?
Hello, everyone. My name is Serena Ulibarri. I've published a lot of short fiction, and I have a novella coming out from Stellafarm Press this year called Another Life, which is an optimistic future. And I run a small press called Worldweaver Press, which published a number of themed anthologies around solar punk, the Glass and Gardens. Solar punk anthologies, as well as multi-species cities that are, you know, challenging the narrative that we're all doomed and there's nothing we can do about it, and also challenging the narrative that, you know, humans are the only creatures worth saving. So those are several, you know, multi-author anthologies that I've helped put together around this topic, as well as my own fiction.
Great, thank you. Ruthanna?
Hi, I'm Ruthanna Emrys. I am an author of a range of hopeful, speculative short stories and novels. Most recently, Half-Built Garden, which is about what happens when the people who have managed to start solving climate change have to deal with first contact. I'm also the author of Wintertide and Deep Roots, which are hopeful, deconstructive Lovecraftiana, and I write the Reading the Weird column with Anne M. Pillsworth, looking over a couple hundred years of weird fiction.
Fantastic. And Matt?
Matthew Kressel. I've written a bunch of short stories, a couple novels, had three Nebula nominations. I co-host the Fantastic Fiction at KGB series in Manhattan with Ellen Datlow, which we have a podcast you could check out too. And if you've ever submitted a story through the Moksha submission system, that's my creation. So yeah, I wear lots of hats.
Wow, I did not know that. That's really interesting. Okay, thank you so much. So we're going to jump in, I think, by maybe just helping get a sense of a definition here to start for those who are watching and to just hear the different viewpoints on it. And so, you know, hope punk as a term first really came into usage in 2017. It was penned by Alexandra Rowland, who is the author of A Conspiracy of Truths and A Choir of Lies. And from there, it's become rather present in usage around these ideas of a recent kind of a punk aesthetic in writing around hope, optimism, kindness, etc. And I'm curious to just kind of have each of you maybe talk a little bit about what hope punk means to you, or how you might see it and define it today in 2023. So what is hope punk in 2023? And what drives you to write optimistic themes and stories of hope? And I'm actually going to start with Kat, particularly because I did want to recognize Kat. You actually have written quite extensively, and you actually teach courses.
I teach a class on writing hope.
Yeah, really wonderful. And I would just direct, I just wanted to say to everyone that I would direct them to your website for as a wonderful resource and bibliography as a portal if you're interested in the topic. But Kat, maybe would you start us off and just give
sure.
us a start
for
you?
Well, I think certainly hope, right, is so important, and it sort of came up as a reaction to grimdark and that sort of very pessimistic outlook that sometimes science fiction can take. And the punk aspect, which I think sometimes we overlook because it got sort of defanged in the case of like steampunk. But it is sort of a maker aesthetic. It is a cooperative aesthetic. It is one where it's kind of like found family. And I think it's very anti-corporate as well, is how I would define at least a stab at hope punk.
And what about you personally as a writer? So what drives you to include optimism?
I think it's so important right now in the face of just this frickin' weird times we live in to emphasize stories of hope and give us stories that give us hope. Because I think it would be very easy to just sort of go, well, end times, and just sort of like sit on your butt and smoke a lot of dope. And I think I'd at least sort of prefer to go down swinging. So, and I think hopeful stories are a way to do that.
Great. Serena, do you want to jump in on that?
So I have to confess that I don't really resonate with the term hope punk myself. When it was first introduced, there was a lot of excitement around it, and it seemed like people were talking about different things when they used the term. Like, some people were using it to describe sort of cozy slice of life, the kind of stories that I like to say, like a book that doesn't need any trigger warnings, right? Like some, you know, something that just is a feel good kind of narrative. The people were using it for that. And then there was that, you know, sort of backlash of like, no, that's not what we're talking about at all. It's this weaponized hope. It's this, you know, and so like on the one hand, people are using it for like Becky Chambers books, which are these wonderful sort of low stakes, you know, speculative fiction. And then they're using it for like The Handmaid's Tale, which is extremely, you know, dark, but, you know, has this undercurrent of hope. And I think most dystopian narratives and most, you know, dark, even, you know, horror has this undercurrent of hope. And so so to me, I don't understand really how hope punk is different from those, the way it, when people use it in that sort of way with this like sort of weaponized hope. So I'm interested to, you know, see what other people on the panel have to say about that. But for me, it's not the hope punk itself is not a term that resonates with what I write. My term is solar punk. But solar punk is specifically optimistic futures that have an environmental focus, where we're dealing with climate change and people surviving, adapting, mitigating climate change, and showing that there is a future beyond this, you know, this catastrophe that is already happening and is going to get worse, but that there is a future, you know, in which we survive that, adapt to it. And I think I encounter a lot of people who, you know, they like the term solar punk, but then they're like, well, but what I'm writing isn't really environmental, so, you know, so then they gravitate toward hope punk as a more general umbrella term. And really, you know, a label is only as useful as, you know, as the people who, you know, well, I don't know what I'm saying here. A label is only useful if it draws people to what they're looking for, Right. And so if, you know, people find the term hope monk and it drives them toward the stories that they're craving, then, you know, then that's really what it's about is, you know, but how it exactly differentiates from other types of stories that use this undercurrent of hope. I'm curious what other people on the panel have to say about that, because I don't quite grasp it myself.
I definitely want to come back to that later too. I have a question marked about thinking about the relationship of cozy versus weaponized optimism, like you had brought up. So we'll definitely come back to that because it's really interesting. Matthew, do you want to follow up on that, and then Ruthanna?
Yeah. I think it's a good segue. I generally try to avoid definitions as a writer because I feel like that's not necessarily up to me. That would be up to perhaps a scholar or a librarian to decide where, or a bookseller, where this particular title lands in the bookstore. Like Serena said, it's really, these terms are enabling readers to find what they like. But as a writer, I generally, when I sit down and do something, I don't say, oh, I'm going to write a solar punk story or I'm going to write a hope punk story. I say, you know, I have this idea. Maybe it has some optimistic elements. Maybe it has some solar punk elements that I want to put into this work, but I don't necessarily classify it that way. And I think, you know, as I think Kat and Serena said, you know, like with punk, you know, this suffix, it seemed to me very overused in the genre. You know, kind of like gate is overused in politics, right? Everything is something gate, everything's something punk, but actually hope punk kind of works because the punk aesthetic is like a rebellious act, right? And to be hopeful in a time of grimness and despair is a rebellious act. So I think the term actually works and is something that kind of brings attention to a specific genre, which I like. But as a writer, I generally don't focus on these terms when I'm sitting down to work on a particular piece.
Ruthanna?
So what I actually resonate with most is Miriam Cava's quote that hope is a discipline. And so when I think about writing hopeful things, I'm thinking not so much about I am thinking about the emotions of it because I'm writing and that's important. But when I think about what makes it hopeful, I'm thinking about what are people acting to do? How are people acting to change the world that they're in? And yeah, as a person, I am an inveterate problem solver. I'm the annoying person who's like, okay, yeah, this sucks. I don't want to process it. What are we going to do about it? And so when I'm writing, I am trying to balance those halves. But to me, what really makes it punk is the action part. And that might be very low-key and cozy, because in a time of grinding capitalism, sometimes stopping and resting and breathing is legitimately both an act of resistance in its own right and also the thing you do so that you can do the long-term fight. So I tend to be a bit of a Katamari Darcy of labels. So if someone says I'm writing hope punk, I'm like, yeah, that works. Someone says I'm writing solar punk, that looks cool to me. The Half Built Garden has ended up with diaper punk because I made a joke about diaper punk in a reading once, and then Malka Older used it to describe it in every quote that she gave about the book while she was waiting 3 years for it to come out. As long as it's helping people to figure out if they want the thing at the intersection of all those things, like Matt, I'm not too worried about actual definitions, and I usually want to finish up the argument about definitions and get into doing the thing.
So I wasn't going to bring this up till later, but since we've gone there, let's just go there now a little bit and talk a little bit maybe about the relationship between cozy and coziness and hope. And I'm thinking particularly, Matt, you were talking about this idea of now and where we are today. And I'm wondering for anyone who wants to chime in, you know, why now? Obviously, I mean, I think we're pretty clear on the conditions of culture and how we're reacting and responding to that. But any thoughts on either cozy or hope? And I'm wondering, has the pandemic in any way contributed to the rise of coziness and care ethics and comfort? You know, I can't help but think that through a difficult time with the pandemic, there's been beautiful moments that have also come forward, whether they're related to human relations and acts of kindness and care towards others, or just this kind of turn towards, you know, I think of Monk and Robe, like cozying up with a cup of tea and kind of finding new appreciation and pleasure out of that. Does anyone have any thoughts on either cozy and hope and its relationship to our present moment? Anyone want to jump in?
I think we might want to just describe the terms a little better, just because in terms of like cozy fiction, I think is a specific thing,
right?
I'm not sure if you're talking about necessarily like coziness in general. But I think that the world, obviously the past few years, you know, someone said recently we're in the third year of 2020. And I said, yeah, that's exactly it. The world has been incredibly stressful for everyone, and everyone has gone through a collective trauma, and everyone is kind of looking for, at least from my point of view, a kind of path out to a better situation. And I think that we're attracted to some of these ideas, at least I am.
Yeah, there's also the saying about comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. And I think coziness that is cozy for people who urgently need some coziness in their lives is different from cozy fiction that is about how nice it is to be an upper class Brit in 1900.
Yeah. I think it's also a reaction to a lot of the narratives that we're surrounded to, where everything is high stakes and everything is the world's about to end. And so it's just, I think sometimes nice to have a story where the stakes are, you know, where is the tomato garden actually going to get planted, right? That sort of thing. There is a pleasure to that and resistance.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. You know, how many of us are going to go, like literally save the world, you know, and how many of us are going to grow a garden in our backyard? Like what is more relatable on a personal level to readers? That could be part of it. For me, it's also a reaction to just late stage capitalism and this idea that we always have to be hustling and we always have to be productive and we always have to be doing something, useful. And so the Monk and Robot stories by Becky Chambers, have this theme of, you know, it's enough to just be, and that you don't have to do anything. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to participate in that hustle. So, and that's, you know, when this world that we live in, the society we live in, that is actually a radical idea. And so to stop and rest and care for yourself and for others is a sort of radical idea within the society.
Yeah, I also, as a Jewish writer, when we describe our holidays, you know, we talk about they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. And the let's eat part is really important. And coziness is part of how we celebrate survival and make it worthwhile.
And I just want to say that my favorite
thing I really like is the change of tempo.
I wanted to say my favorite scene in A Half-Built Garden is the Pesach scene, the Passover scene, where everything just stops and you're like, nope, we gotta clean, we gotta cook, we gotta do this thing, and let's invite the aliens. And it's just an amazing moment of stopping and observing and turning inward. And I just adore that scene. And it's exactly what we're talking about here.
Well, maybe we can expand on that a little bit. I'd love to hear from each of you. What are some of the ways like that you actually go about strategizing and using certain tactics in world building or in other ways in your writing to do that and to achieve that kind of simple pleasure or that concept of homeliness? Or Kat, I'm thinking about cooking and hospitality and You Sexy Thing, right?
Yeah.
So maybe if you would start, but then if anyone sure. wants to continue and maybe talk a little bit about your own work and the ways that you go about doing this.
And that, yeah, I, one of the reasons that I, my crew of former mercenaries has turned restaurateurs is because the act of cooking things together requires a team in the same way military stuff requires a team. And so I like writing about food. And I think there's so much about relationships that come out in the acts of preparing food, in the acts of consuming it, in the acts of even cleaning up, that it is just, plus you get to test bake every once in a while. So I love writing about food. But I'm sorry, it's not very hope punk. But you know, that's like meals are communal things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's very much about the relationships. And I think that is one of the things that hope punk is about, is not so much kind of like the chosen one doing marvelous things so much as it is about the people and the interactions. And there is no chosen one because it's a group.
That's really interesting. You know, in my own personal background, in my other world, I'm an art historian, but also an artist who is involved with a lot of participatory collectives and socially engaged art. And most of my influence in writing comes from these kinds of meal-based hospitality events and things like that, which are so important. And it makes me, Serena, think also what you're talking about, late-stage capitalism and the collectivism as a counter to the individualism, which is such a strong current too in there. Do you want to follow on that a little bit? I mean, I know in some of your work you talk a lot, or you do have scenarios involving agribusiness, food production, animals, et cetera. Do you want to chime in on that at all?
Sure. So nobody's read it yet except my editor, but my novella that's coming out, Another Life, starts with a meal scene and has several meal scenes throughout. And one of the subtle details that that I put in all of the meal scenes, I think, is that everyone's sitting around a table or standing around a preparation counter or something, and the character arrives and everyone moves to make space for her to come in. That's a subtle detail that I put in to indicate this sort of like adjusting to accommodate and, you know, and this community sort of expanding and contracting as needed. And that always happens, you know, someone new arrives at the table, they adjust the chairs and make space. And so that's a tiny little world building detail. I don't know if anyone's going to notice, but I mean, you know, I'm putting it out there, so now they will. But, So the story you're probably referring to, Jonathan, is Spiral Ranch, which is a short story I published in Dreamforge, and it's been reprinted and translated a couple times. So this is a story of a world in which to adapt to climate change, the farms, ranches have been sort of shut down and rewilded into carbon sequestration forests. You just plant a lot of trees and you rewild it. And as a result, agriculture has shifted toward the cities into vertical farms, which are becoming more common now, are growing indoors and LED lights and such. My story is based around a vertical ranch where they're raising cows in a skyscraper with a pasture that spirals up. And the cows are raised just in the middle of the city in this skyscraper. And then we have a conflict where there's some ranchers who want to take it back to the old ways, and they're using a drone to like abduct the cows and take them back out to the fields. And
when cows fly, right?
Serena? Yeah. It's a fun image of the cow like being carried across, you know, the city of Austin by a drone. So it's a fun story, but what it's about, you know, is our relationship with food and agriculture. And it's also like, I have the character who sort of is the cowgirl, you know, dealing with the animals, and then her former best friend who is, you know, at the very top of this tower in the office and never deals with the animals and is dealing with all the corporate stuff, and how, you know, they had this dream together of, you know, of creating this you know strange new way to still have, you know, meat and cheese and things like that in a solar punk world, and they're driven apart by the pressures of running this business and just, you know, all that. So so they're physically, you know, apart in the skyscraper, and then over the course of the story they, you know, physically come together and also emotionally sort of come back together. I don't know that kind of fits like the theme that you're talking about of, you know, just at least community and kindness and, how, you know, food plays, you know, such an important role in all of our relationships.
And Ruthanna, that's great. And Ruthanna, would you follow that maybe with, I'm curious to hear a little bit about maybe social design more broadly, let's say around family dynamics and even communication in your book, or your most recent book, and just how you approached that as a means to kind of push forward, right, this kind of social set of social relations in an interesting way.
So I'm a cognitive psychologist by training, and a lot of what I was thinking about when I was trying to imagine future forms of social organization was, what if instead of making people adapt the way they think to their technologies, we came up with technologies that were adapted to the ways of thinking that are both comfortable and effective for us. So designing for people to be both lower stress and better at making decisions. So there is a lot in the book about technology being integrated with life in a very different way than it is now, in a way that feels more, I want to say, organic, and that feels more like our natural ways of perceiving and interacting with the world, but more so. So there's a lot of people being able to dive into the details of what's around them. You can be going around and walking around your neighborhood, and instead of listening to a podcast or music that is separating you from your environment, you can learn more about the environment around you and get more depth on where things come from and how they're doing and what problems you might be able to solve and what problems you've successfully solved, and that this helps to draw people closer together. And then various characters have hobbies that they do, as humans do, and one of those is that one of the characters is a knitter, and she has a sweater swarm that she's knit that lets people connect to each other via radio by wearing this related set of sweaters. And this is not one of the big technologies that has changed the world, but it's one that's in keeping with sort of the aesthetic that culture has gone down.
I love that. And there's the wealth of creative sort of futurisms that you put together in the book is really, it's truly amazing and really interesting. I kept thinking when you were talking about things like the distraction thesis and how you counter that so much in the way that you construct that sort of network of social relations in such a wonderful way. And Matthew, do you want to chime in? And again, you can please speak on whatever you want. But in my mind, I was thinking about a lot of your, or at least some of your stories that I've read involve terraforming and looking really at a much, maybe more distant relations between humans and the galaxy around them, and not colonization maybe so much in the strict sense of the word, but could you speak a little bit about maybe in that context or something else around that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was as the others were talking, I was thinking about two specific examples. So, like my near future stories, generally were focused on the tension between the world we want and the world we have. So, in The Marsh of Camarina, it's near future where, and at the time I wrote this, it was speculative that AIs were taking over computer science jobs. Just this morning, I watched a YouTube video where someone went to ChatGPT and said, write me Arduino code to flash an LED. And it wrote it, and he put it in the Arduino, and it worked. And it's not perfect, but this is just gonna take off. So in the story, this young woman graduates from Georgia Tech, top of her class, you know, not top of her class, but you know, very, very high GPA, but there's happens to be no jobs in programming, because you know, all it takes is a you know, an executive to type in a sentence in a piece of software, and then they have the code. So what do they need to pay someone $100,000 a year for? So Canada ends up creating this kind of experimental community in this wilderness area. So she goes up there, and it's kind of this anarcho-socialist community. And basically, they're like, you can do whatever you want here. You don't have to do anything, but, you know, pick something that you're good at that you can help with. And she very quickly realizes that she could program the bots that take care of the farms, because she's good at it. It's old software. She could do it in her sleep, but it's something to do. But a lot of the community there is arranged around the meals, around, like, you know, people have like music that they all get together and listen to, and like each one has like a special thing that they're known for. And you know, I think part of the tension in this story is the protagonist trying to figure out, well, what do I do in a world like that's post-capitalist? Like, where, how do I fit into this? Because we're so used to this capitalist thinking, as others have said, to do, right? So what is it like in a world where you don't necessarily have to do something? So where do you put your energies? And then, so that was like near future. But then the far future stuff, as you were talking about, I generally have envisioned this world where it's post-scarcity, in the sense that everyone is provided their basic needs. There are kiosks basically everywhere in this world, and specifically in this far future novel I'm writing, you could just go, you could print your clothes, you could get food. It's 1,000 years in the future, so they still have coffee shops. People still socialize and sit around coffee, you know, and have a cup of coffee and talk and eat donuts, and that's still a thing in the future. And also just this idea that, you know, and this may be getting slightly off topic, but just this idea that, you know, that on Earth we have like such a beauty and abundance of life, and bringing that abundance of life to another world is something that I find very hopeful and optimistic. Now, of course, there's questions on whether or not we should do that, or do we have the right to bring life to a world? What if there was existing life on that world, and then we bring our own bacteria or whatever and changes it? That's a whole different discussion. But just that whole idea of bringing life to a new world and bringing beauty and creating this whole ecosystem and life is something that I find really, really motivating and optimistic when I'm working on this stuff. And it's this kind of grand sort of overarching vision that motivates a lot of my work, at least right now. But yeah, so I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's making me want to follow up with a question to whomever wants to chime in, just about thinking about also species relations and creating diverse species worlds, whether those are have various degrees of sentience. And we won't get into the debate over sentience, but, you know, what is it that maybe is advantageous as writers interested in these types of themes about using non-human, let's say, non-human characters, non-human populations in various ratios too, or a first contact scenario. Does anyone want to chime in about that at all? Any thoughts?
I can jump in. So I co-edited this anthology called Multi-Species Cities, which is exactly what you're talking about. The premise that we asked writers to submit was essentially envision urban spaces that are not solely human focused. And so we have a variety of stories in this anthology that range from stories like a teenager having to do community service and sort of forming a relationship and appreciation with a bird that she encounters through her community service, and to like a setting on Mars where there are no animals, but there's a robot dog. And so there's still like a relationship with like a non-human and a pet and a creature that's helping humans, and humans are helping it and all that. So it's got a very broad spectrum of stories, but the focus is all on our relationship with just reimagining our relationship with the rest of the natural world. I'm going to say the natural world because humans are part of the natural world, and so dissolving that imaginary separation that we have, and doing so in an urban environment, which we often the soil is all sealed, and it's all focused on human commerce and things like that. But I can look out my window right now and see like several different species of birds, like just right there. And I am just sort of becoming aware of that. Like I've lived my whole life without seeing these birds that are right there, and I'm just starting to learn to know them, and that I share the world with them. So I don't have anything like super intelligent to say about that, but the anthology itself, the authors in the anthology have very smart things to say about this topic, and there's just it's a very hopeful, optimistic futures to me are futures where we are in more balance with the other species we share the world with, as well as AI and aliens and things like that. So there's I don't know. I'm gonna stop rambling now.
If Gareth had made it, we would have talked about sentient ships for sure.
I think a lot about the ways that modern cities are actually wondrously multi-species compared to the way they were a century and a half ago. So there's this story about how squirrels were first reintroduced to New York City to try and give people some connection to the wilderness that they had left. And they died because there was no green space. There was nothing for them to eat. And there was this whole movement both around green space and about the degree to which humans were obligated to feed the squirrels so that they could have squirrels in the city. And we now think of them, as we think about our feral pigeons, sometimes as pests, but we have so much more than we used to, and it's still so sparse compared to what we could have. I love rewilding work. I love the efforts that we're doing to rebuild richer ecologies in a way that acknowledges that we're going to be a part of them, and would love to see more of that on an urban level and see more maybe do more writing about that on an urban level. Like, I love to write aliens. There are snarky aliens in everything that I write, but I also want to challenge myself to think more about the ways we communicate with things that do not learn to speak fluent English, and the ways that we can acknowledge that there is communication going on, you know, with birds, with plants, that we could be a part of without having it look like an ordinary human dialogue.
So I'm going to turn us, unless someone else wants to speak on that topic, I'm going to turn us a little more towards storytelling and ask all of you to respond to the question, what does strength look like to you in stories of hope? This is a question that I really am very interested in, because I think there's a tendency to default to strength in particular ways in stories that involve change and where there's effective change. And I'm curious to hear, how do you build characters with strength in stories of hope and optimism? And how do they accomplish that change through that kind of profile that you have for them? So I thought, Matthew, I'll start with you, maybe.
I mean, I'm thinking, for an example, in my current novel, I realized that I got all the way to the end and not a single shot was fired. But there's definitely an epic arc to it. And I think I did that intentionally, but I don't have like specific memories of why I did it that way. I just knew that, you know, this character does not solve problems through violence. This character solves problems through unrelenting hope, and just like she's really clever, but you know, grit as well. So it's like, you know, not just saying, oh, I'm gonna, you know, get my weapons and we're gonna have this, you know, this big orc army or this whatever, you know, and we're gonna have this mammoth battle. It's like, no, I'm gonna like, you know, as what's his name said in The Martian, I'm gonna science my way through this, or I'm gonna, you know, engineer my way through this, or I'm gonna, deal with it on an interpersonal level. So it's just like, I guess it's sort of rethinking narrative arc, right? So there's like that sort of hero's journey, and you know, there's even books on it now that like tell you like chapter by chapter, here's what your protagonist should do. And you see this in a lot of movies and certain types of fiction where it's just like, it ends with a big battle, right? And I'm trying to rethink that arc and what makes a satisfying story. And I think for me, it's an emotional payoff. And there are many, many ways to bring that payoff. And I think it's extremely satisfying to have that payoff come without any violence.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thanks. Kat, do you want to follow on that? Because I'm thinking about your book and, right, I mean, how it maybe works a slightly different way.
I'm thinking actually about a moment in the movie Mona, the Disney one, which I use in the Hope Punk class, which is at the end, where she says to the volcano goddess, I see you, I know who you are. And she goes forward to talk, you know, to confront her in the face of her, of the goddess, and kind of like comes down on all fours and is like rushing at her. And it's just that fearlessness and that willing to be vulnerable, even in the face of anger, even in the face of what is a very, you know, often when you try to reach to somebody in pain, their first reaction is anger and is fear. So I think in Hope Punk, strength, it's a strength of will. It's a strength. It's a willingness to be open. It's a willingness to be vulnerable. And it's a fearlessness, I think, but not a fearlessness so much as it is a, yeah, I'm afraid, but I'm going to push forward.
Yeah.
Do you want to just maybe elaborate a little more and use an example from your own work or talk a little bit about?
Well, in Devil's Gun, there is a moment, and I don't want to give spoilers, but like where they all go into a very horrible place, and they all have to just sort of go forward. And there is a moment where one of them is kind of like, I don't know if I want to keep going. And it's just like, but I have no choice. And it just, I think that sort of, I don't know, there's a willingness to roll with the punches that I think makes for a good hero. And I think it's important.
Great. Thanks. Serena, you want to follow on that?
Yeah, I think... In solarpunk and in a lot of things people call hope punk, you know, the narrative is a little different than the typical you know, character as a goal and there are obstacles in the way that they must overcome. It's less of that, of like driving the narrative through will, and more of like, you know, surviving the story, surviving the circumstances, and more of like internal growth through that. So surviving and adapting and keeping or coming back to at least the hope and optimism that there is a way through this, even if, you know, the narrative itself is rather, you know, dark, or they're dealing with you know, really kind of pessimistic things, keeping the optimism, keeping the hope in a way that is definitely strength. It definitely takes strength to keep that optimism in the face of negative things.
Sometimes the hardest choices, right? Come in different guises. Yeah, interesting. Ruthanna, would you like to chime in on that, what strength looks like?
Yeah, I think a lot about a thing that Scott Lynch said at ReaderCon a few years back, talking about heist stories and ensemble stories more generally, and the ways that an ensemble story is inherently about the way we need each other. And that strength is not a thing that there's only one type of. You know, we live in a society that is very much about who's the smartest, who's the strongest, put everything on a scale, grade it, and figure out the best and the worst. And when you're writing multiple characters working together, that frees you to describe different types of strength that work well together and complement each other, and the ways that something can be both a strength and a vulnerability, and that strengths work best when we recognize what other people are bringing to the table, and as Serena said, move to make room for them so that there are now more people and more strengths at the table. So, you know, I write big group families because I live in a big group family, but I also write big group families because I love being able to write something where you have the person who is good at going out and interfacing with the world, and the person who likes to stay home and cook when you suddenly learn that first contact is going to be taking place in your house, and the person who knows how to make the machines go, and the person who knows all the other people and knows who to reach out to when you don't have the strengths within that central group, and to start portraying strength as this web of intersections that make society something where we recognize and accept and love our need for each other. And to me, that's a core part of writing hopeful things, that they go beyond the protagonist, who is the person who can make a difference, to talking about how we work together to make a difference, and how there's room for all of us in making that difference.
That's really interesting. I've written a one of my novels is a heist, and Scott Lynch's words are really interesting to think about, because embedded in there absolutely is this idea that whatever they're working towards is bigger than any one of them. And they're all willing to work with people they might not even like, right? Because this thing is more important. And that's so true. It's really, really certainly, it definitely is interesting.
It's interesting too, because some of the recent heist shows I saw, and I'm specifically thinking of Kaleidoscope, if anyone has seen that, is like nobody trusts each other, right? So you bring in these collection of people, but everybody is like, you know, mistrusting of others or pulling the, you know, some scam on everyone else. And it's just sort of very reflective, I think, of where we are as a society, where it's like everyone is paranoid if everyone else is going to steal from them, but we all need to work together somehow. It's, I don't know, it just came to mind.
So let's talk about endings. And this is, I admit, this is probably the question that I've been most excited to get answers from all of you on. Because I think, just like we were talking a little bit about character arcs, what's important for you in an ending to a story that involves hope and optimism? That, you know, how clean does the ending become for you, or where do you like to see an ending leave a longer, let's say, narrative trajectory when it involves hope and optimism? And I'll just go right back to you, Matthew, and maybe start with you on that.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that distinguishes optimistic fiction is the ending, right? So, I think personally, it was just my engagement with optimistic fiction is just a reaction to sort of a nihilistic trend, for lack of a better term, that I saw in a lot of fiction. That it was just like, not quite grimdark, but grimdark is part of it. Just this, you know, everything is bleak, nothing means anything, there is no hope. There was just so much of this fiction out there. I love the movie Blade Runner. I know it's extremely bleak, but there was a period, after Blade Runner, up until really recently, where when you said future, you got a Blade Runner city. Like anywhere you looked on digital art, you looked in film, it was just like bleak and dystopian. And so, I mean, my attraction to optimistic fiction, it was direct reaction to that. It was like, I want to do something different. I want something better. And we're seeing that a lot more now. And I think a lot more people are conscious of that now, which I find is good. But in terms of like the ending of a story, I feel like it's important for me personally, to inspire some kind of romantic feeling about the value of having an optimistic look on the future. Like just feeling that tomorrow could be a better day than today, right? So it's like, there's that famous Bradbury story, All Summer in a Day, right? So the kids are living on a world where it rains constantly, and then the one day it's sunny, they all go outside into the sun, and it's this miraculous thing, and unfortunately, one girl is locked in a closet and doesn't get to see the sun, and it's horrifying. Ray Bradbury, damn you. But I often use this metaphor when I'm talking about like optimistic fiction, is that if you constantly fill, you know, the bookshelves with pessimistic stuff, no one's going to be clamoring for an optimistic future, because it's not going to be something that they're used to, because it's going to be that one sunny day. But if you have all these different sunny days and then suddenly you don't get your sunny day, you're going to be like, where's my sunny day? So I feel like we need to have more optimistic stuff out there so people can say, oh, this future is possible. This future is possible. This future is possible. Where is it? Why don't I have this future? Why are we doing these horrible, bleak things? This is not inevitable. I guess I'm trying to change the supposed inevitability of these dystopian futures.
what was it? Frederick Jameson famously said something that I quote a lot to my students, right? It's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism, right? Yeah, that's very, really, really, I have a lot. There's a lot to think about there. Thanks. Kat, I'm going to go to you next and let you answer that since you're short on time.
I am. So I think that, as you said, to despair doesn't take a lot of work, whereas to kind of be like, oh, there can be a better future and it's possible does take work. And I think that's one of the things that the Hope Punk ending needs to show is that our efforts have some meaning to them. That, you know, maybe it's just the meaning is people work well together. You know, like recently D&D, the D&D people backed down on a really unpopular decision. And it was because the community came together. It really was a wonderful example of a corporation, a big corporation saying, oh, well, shit, maybe not. So I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Kat, would you like to just let everyone know where they can reach you and what you have coming up, since I know you have to leave a little early?
I do have to, and I'm terribly remiss because I wanted to mention that I also work with a Hope Punk podcast, in which I do have to, one of my co-hosts is actually in the chat. I see you, Alan. And we recently interviewed Cory Doctorow and Rebecca Gibbler on their book, Choke Point Capitalism. And just yesterday, Alan and I interviewed Rika Aoki, just absolutely wonderful book, Light from Uncommon Stars. So please check out the podcast. Has been around for 4 years now and started because we're like, let's do a project together. And then it was like, let's do Hope Punk. And so that's the best place to find me at the moment. So I'm going to
put that in the chat for sure.
Awesome. Thank you, folks. Take care.
Thank you.
It's been lovely.
Good seeing you.
So Ruthanna, why don't you go ahead and then there were three, well, four. Ruthanna, why don't you go ahead and maybe follow on Kat there and talk a little bit about endings.
Yeah, so I am very bad at writing clean endings. I don't believe in them. I don't trust them. The ending that feels most natural to me and that I tend to write is, and then they made an interesting decision. And something that makes a turning point that opens up possibilities for change. And perhaps not coincidentally, my favorite sort of sequel is, these are all the problems caused by the solutions that we came up with last time. I love a good eucatastrophe, but
yeah,
I think that a lot of hopeful endings are ones that are not strictly endings, that open room for change and room for new action. And I had another
thing. It's like a dialectic moving, uh-huh, right? Yeah. Interesting. It's interesting. I feel similarly as well, that the ending point for me is now it's time to get started. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel about the ending.
It's I'm thinking of the example, right, that Kat gave of that we just made this change in a little thing that makes a lot of people's lives and ability to tell stories better, and it literally opens up possibilities for storytelling. But I'm also thinking about my own experience with trying to make change and succeeding, which is that the very first serious activism that I ever got into was in high school, where I was involved in our ecology club, and we were working to try and do something about the hole in the ozone layer. And that is now at the point where I was reading a post the other day where someone was like, haha, isn't it funny? All these left-wing folks used to complain about the hole in the ozone layer, and now you don't hear anything about it. And it's because it worked, that we are well on our way to that It's about half solved. It's going in the right direction. It's probably going to be back to 1980 levels sometime in the next, I think, 20 years. But it wasn't a thing where there was a climactic moment in the 1990s. You know, we made the change. We did get the moment of outlawing the CFCs and having an international agreement about that. But then it takes a long, quiet time for the solution to actually work. And by the time the solution is working, you have people who are convinced that it wasn't ever a real problem to begin with because no one's talking about it anymore. And I think we need more narratives about what actually solving problems and then seeing the change looks like on a non-internet timeline.
Serena, do you want to follow that and talk a little about endings? And I'm going to, before you start, I'm just going to mention something from the chat that you might also be interested in addressing, that there's a chat coming in talking a little bit about also particularly solar punk stories coming out of the global south and thinking about a kind of global perspective, whether global south, global north, with regard to solar punk. And then also someone wanted to know the title of your upcoming book. So I know I just put a lot on your plate, but we'll start with endings if you want to talk about that, and then I can give you a reminder.
Sure. So I agree with what has been said by the others about endings. I think of it as being an optimistic ending, being generative, meaning like, you know, if I get to the end of a hopeful, optimistic story and I think, well, that's nice and everything works out and close the book and good, I don't have to ever think about that again. I just feel good. You know, that's not the kind of optimistic ending that, that inspires me or drives me. It's the ones that make me want to look into the technology or the idea that was presented in the story. It's the ones that make me want to, you know, go out into the world and do something or at least change my perspective, my paradigm. And really, that's just good writing craft. That's what we're all striving to do as writers, is create some kind of internal change for the reader. And with optimistic endings, you know, the danger is this naivety, this like the passivity of hope. I am a story reviewer also for the Imagine 2200 climate fiction contest, which is always looking for these optimistic futures. And one of the things in our reviewer guidelines is the term Pollyanna-ish. It's like, is this story too hopeful, too optimistic? Does it brush aside the challenges of it? And those are not the kind of stories we're looking for. It's the stories that, you know, do acknowledge the challenges and the grit of it, and that inspire. So that's what's important for the ending of this kind of story, is that generative nature, that inspiration. And I think a good example that's just a cultural touchstone is Star Trek, the original series. And, you know, we can look at Star Trek through the lens of our current, ethics and find all kinds of problems with it. But really, it was a utopian vision that came directly out of the space race and the civil rights movement. And there are all kinds of examples of engineers and scientists and, all kinds of people who were inspired by things from Star Trek to bring them into reality. And, you know, that's sort of the ultimate goal of optimistic fiction, I think, is to shift us as a culture more toward a future like that. You know, maybe not that specific vision, but to move us in that trajectory rather than the trajectory we're on.
I find it so interesting, and I'm curious to hear from all of you. I find it so interesting how much of what we're all doing really avoids the utopian project. In a way, right? It's kind of like, we don't want that finality and the problems of universalism or whatever it might be that comes with it, right? We're more about the trajectory and envisioning something as an alternative to that. And I think there's a tendency sometimes to put utopia together with optimistic futurist writing. And it's just an interesting thought that's just coming into my head. But you brought up something else, Serena, so I'm just going to roll with it, and I'm going to ask Matthew and then Ruthanna to talk about it, and we can come back to you if you want to add anything. But since you brought it up, I was going to ask, what should we be mindful of, right, when writing optimistic futures? Like, what are some of the pitfalls to watch out for, right? What are some of the areas where things can get problematic, and what are those problems, and how do you grapple with them? Matthew, sure. We'll start with you.
Yeah, so just jumping off of what Serena said, I think, I tend to see utopia as a verb, not a noun. It's something you work towards. And I think that it's important to understand that not everyone's utopia is going to be the same, right? So you could have this perfect vision of utopia that, you know, someone else is like, no, that's hell, right? That's, I don't want that. So I think what's important is to make sure we have a diversity of voices in the space, so that we're not just dealing with Western English voices, for example, just other points of view. I think some of this Afrofuturism stuff is really great, and I'm excited about some of it, which I can talk later about, but. And then I think, you know, just the what others have said in terms of like making it clear that these are not easy problems to solve, that they have there's an enormous amount of momentum in our current system that is going to be very, very difficult to overcome. And maybe we do overcome some of it, but this brings in like other problems. And, you know, a very real world example I can think of is, yeah, you know, we all want to switch to a renewable infrastructure. We all want to switch to electric cars and wind power, et cetera. But to power our cars, we need, you know, lithium ion batteries. And where do we get the lithium from? Well, that's really dirty and gross mining. And then I got into an argument with someone who was basically saying, well, we should just stop mining lithium. And I'm like, well, then we're stuck with oil, right? So it's like, it's, these issues are not simple, and I think that as a fiction writer, and this is actually good for us as fiction writers, is it creates a lot of tension, right? Is because you have these multiple ideas all going at once, and I think as Ruthanna and Serena said, is like, you know, you get to the end of the story, but it's not the end; it's just the beginning. So anyway,
Ruthanna.
Interesting that Serena brought up Star Trek, which is legitimately an example of hopeful fiction that has moved a lot of people to act and try and change the world. I read an interesting post the other day that was from some people who had worked as Star Trek writers, who were talking about an argument that they had gotten into with people who were saying, well, we can't have this, you know, post-scarcity future without inventing replicators. And they were saying, no, it's the other way around. The reason that replicators lead to a post-scarcity future in Star Trek is because they already have the sort of society that when replicators are invented will make sure that they're used to give everyone access to food and the things that they need, rather than that they get patented by a private company and costs enough that only the billionaires can afford to have them and use them to get even richer and make the world even more unequal. And so, because it's just like I bumped into yesterday, but it's making me think about the ease with which we can think of the technologies as a solution rather than as a tool, and the shape of the society and the way we organize ourselves as a thing that follows rather than a thing that we do deliberately. I've also been reading Rayburn, When Roused the Dawn of Everything, which is very much about trying to increase our political imagination as a way of opening up new futures. So I think that, you know, one of our failure modes, and it's not necessarily it can be a failure mode of the author or of the readers, is not thinking about how social changes shape the way we use our tools rather than just the way our tools shape our society, because both of those things do happen. And if you focus just on one, you get something like the idea of crypto comes originally from a Neal Stephenson novel, but he probably did not have in mind setting up crypto such that it uses more fossil fuels than small countries.
Yeah, that's like, for me in my series, that's why ethics is the driving factor, really. And that has to change. And if that doesn't change, the rest of it won't change in its materialization as it moves forward. Serena, did you want to add anything to that before there's a question in the chat I'm going to get to before we begin to close out, but we have time if you'd like to respond.
Sure. I think that Matthew and Ruthanna both got to the heart of it, that there's the pitfall of optimism or writing optimistic fiction is the danger of the single solution, right? And not understanding the full implications of everything and the political and the racial and the ecological and how all of these things work together. And so, you know, often we see this like techno solution of like, you know, just do this and it'll fix everything. Well, and then it creates other problems or you don't understand where the resources for that come from and how those are tied up in other problems. So, the danger of the single solution. And I'm going to jump back to that question of the global South that's related to this too. So like in the early days of solar punk, when a lot of people were talking about solar punk and not really writing it yet, or there weren't a lot of works yet that people could look at specifically, or just talk about the idea of solar punk as a world where we have switched to renewable energies. And there's just this there was a lot of reaction of like, well, that would be a utopia. And, you know, then we, my company helped, funded the translation of the original solar punk anthology from Brazil that was written in Portuguese. We funded the translation of that into English to bring those stories into the conversation about solar punk. And it is debatable how optimistic those stories are. Some of them are, and some of them are very dark. But you know, the premise that the editor put out was just a world that runs on renewable energy. And what we ended up with is stories of green capitalism and, you know, greenwashing and corruption and things like that. And, you know, and it makes a lot of sense coming out of Brazil. Brazil is a country that runs on primarily like hydroelectric, I think, and other forms of renewable energy. And it is not a utopia by any means. And because there are all these other issues that are tied up in that. And so, you know, the single solution, also living in a bubble, you know, and only thinking about the way that these things work within, you know, within North America, for example, or within, you know, Europe, and ignoring the way that they work in the global South and the resources that, you know, exploitation of labor and things that come from, you know, other parts of the world, and not bring those into consideration. That's a real danger with, you know, optimistic futures, is if you are only optimistic for a small part of the world and ignore the implications for all the rest of it.
And if we only had a lot more time, I would love to talk more about this in the relationship between a Earth specific context and then a secondary world or galactic context, where all sorts of factors, I think, would come into play, both challenging and beneficial. But we just don't have time. So, but that would be great. There is a question in the chat that I'm going to ask, and then after that, we'll start to wrap up. But the question is, how do you add conflict or adventure and overall fun and action like cyberpunk does, but in solar punk, hope punk? Is it something you try to do? And if so, is it challenging? Anyone want to jump in on that?
I mean, there's always opportunities for conflict whenever you have two people interacting. I mean, in my fiction, I think at least in the near future stuff, I focus on more of the, like I said before, on the tension between where we are now and where we want to be, and how that creates tensions for characters to want to do something but can't. I mean, I think like the traditional character arc, right, is like your character really wants something and something stands in the way of it. So what is that? And then that's where your story genesis lies. And I don't think that, you know, I think we also need to rethink, you know, narratives. If every narrative has to have some form of like violence or, you know, epic scope, you know, there are lots of other narratives that don't have that, but they can be extremely affecting and emotionally compelling. And so I think that, you know, there's always room for conflict and adventure whenever you're dealing with human beings.
Anyone else?
So yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Serena, and then Ruthanna.
Sorry about that. I did think of my story, The Spiral Ranch, which I mentioned earlier. I did think of that as an adventure story when I was writing it. And it is, I took like tropes from Westerns, because it's a story about cattle rustling. And so I was like, what does cattle rustling look like when you raise cows or when you raise cattle, not on a ranch, but in a skyscraper? And, you know, how do you abduct the cows and things like that? And so it was, you know, I had this strange world building, which I took just from a piece of conceptual architecture that I saw. And you know, that generated the idea of like, okay, who works there? How would that function? Where would it be? Things like that. And then I put around that just the tropes of a, you know, a Western adventure. And, you know, and it's a lot of fun. And I wrote it kind of to show that you can have conflict and adventure in a world like that. And it's rather different than a lot of other solar punk or hope punk stories, but it was because I was intentionally trying to do that adventure. So I think you can take the tropes of other genres and apply it to these principles and still, you know, have a fun and, you know, conflict-driven story if the world building is all based around these ideas of hope and optimism.
It's a great story. Lots of action in there for sure. Ruthanna?
Yeah, and similarly, I was going to also talk about reaching out to other genres. I think we end up in speculative fiction sometimes with some very narrow ideas of what conflict can be, in spite of the fact that we often do end up with things like the Monk and Robot books by Becky Chambers, where the conflict is someone in essentially a utopia discovering that they no longer feel drawn to the career that they once found so rewarding, and that is one of the things that makes the utopia a utopia. And that is a real thing that happens to people even under the best of circumstances and makes for worthwhile conflict with very little in the way of crash bang. I read a lot of romance, and I love the way that makes conflict out of people trying to find a way to be happier. And that can be applied not only to pair bonding, but to people trying to pull together in larger groups or in different types of pairs. So conflict in friendship, conflict in colleagues trying to work together on a project, but a conflict that is primarily humans are always going to have trouble creating relationships and always be drawn to create relationships.
Yeah, and I'll add also, you know, like I said, using a heist, you know, to accomplish something along the way, even if it means going against maybe the, you know, the system itself to be able to overthrow the system. works, but also even around colonization, diaspora and diasporic resistance. There's so many opportunities and ways in which, you know, action and conflict can occur in those kinds of stories. So I think we're winding down here, and I wanted to, before we go around for a final moment, I wanted to ask, do any of you have anything that you wanted to ask any of your fellow panelists or anything that you wanted to raise? Matthew, you did mention something about talking about Afrofuturism a moment ago, but was there anything else that anyone wanted to bring up or ask of your fellow panelists? Anybody? No. Matthew, did you want to make a comment or a couple of remarks about, you were talking about other areas of writing and stories. And I know
I think, like, it's important, like I said, to make sure that we, you know, as we're talking about these ideas, as we're doing stuff, and I think, you know, Serena and Ruthanna both are doing great things in this area, is just like bringing voices into the discussion that might have different points of view from us, and making sure that we include them in the conversation. So, you know, obviously, like, Afrofuturism is part of that, but there's this, you know, other examples of fiction, you know, South Asian, et cetera, you know, basically as much as we can, because, you know, there's 8 billion of us on this planet and 8 billion point of view. And it's, and just because, you know, we're all sitting, you know, at a conference and there's a, you know, maybe a, you know, a couple hundred people view this or whatever, and we all agree, doesn't mean that everyone else does. And I just think it's really important to do that. And I think one of the most powerful things of fiction is being able to put yourself in someone else's point of view and empathize with them and see it from their point of view. And it's extremely powerful. And yeah, so that's where I wanted to go.
Well, thank you to all three of you, and Kat, who had to leave early, for being here today and for contributing with such a rich conversation. So much to think about even now leaving, so much left to talk about, but of course there's always hope. I'd like to go around and ask each of you, if you could for a moment, to let us know either something that you have that's upcoming or something that was a recent release that you can let the viewers know about. Where can we find you? And then also, if you have one recommendation of something that's under the bubble of what we talked about today that you want to give a shout out to, that would be great. So why don't we go ahead and start, Ruthanna, with you.
Let's see, I've already mentioned that A Half-Built Garden came out last year. I am regularly on my Patreon and on Reading the Weird on Tor.com. And let me see, I did something to shout out to. There were several parts of the question.
I've already shout mentioned- out to, yeah.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I've already mentioned The Dawn of Everything, which I am finding fascinating and thought-provoking, and then I'll go in the direction of a weird one, but I love when I find punk, solar punk optimism in formats other than traditional narrative. I just went to a new Afrofuturist restaurant in Northeast DC called Bronze the other day, which was very cool. And I love people speculating about what would food look like in this better future, in this alternate universe. And would love to see more of that and have places to do that succeed.
That sounds amazing. And where can people find you?
I am on my Patreon, which is just under my name. I am sometimes, although not as much as I used to be, on Twitter under r_Emrys. And on Mastodon, I'm r_Emrys at Wandering Shop.
Great. Thank you. Serena?
So my novella is called Another Life, and it's coming out from Stelliform Press in May, hopefully, if I finish my edits on time. And the premise, it takes place in a solar punk small solar punk city in Death Valley, California. And the premise is that what if we could prove that reincarnation was real and you could find out who you were in a previous life? So we have sort of the leader of this peaceful community in Death Valley finding out that she was a really bad person in her previous life. And how does that affect her view of her own identity and her role within this community, and how does the community respond? So that's what that's about. I also have a story in an anthology that just came out. The anthology is called Bioluminescent, and it is the first lunar punk anthology. So yet another label to add to this collection of optimistic futures. Lunar punk is kind of solar punk at night, or with more spiritual aspects involved. So it's the idea of turning inward, or, you know, what does solar punk community look at like at night? There are all kinds of visions of optimistic futures that are attempting to define this sort of new term of lunar punk. So that is called Bioluminescent. And that just came out. In terms of shout outs, I do definitely want to say A Half Built Garden by Ruthanna Emrys, and it is an amazing subversion of the first contact tropes. I highly recommend it. And I will also say this isn't fiction, but it's something that I think everyone who's interested in these topics should read, is Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. If you haven't read that yet and you're interested in this type of fiction, the ethos of this type of fiction is what Braiding Sweetgrass is all about. So
lunar punk, I terms or no terms, I love it. Okay, Matthew, if you could let us know as well, that would be great.
Sure. So I co-wrote a story called Threat Assessment with Mercurio de Rivera, which is subversively optimistic. I don't want to say too much because it will spoil it, but the premise is a psychoanalyst is brought up to the moon to analyze a evil AI, basically the world's most evil AI. It's very Philip K. Dickian and subversively optimistic. So I also have a story that's just out in an anthology called Other Covenants, Alternate Histories of the Jewish People. The story is called White Roses in Their Eyes, and it is an alternate history Anne Frank. So in this world, the Holocaust never happens, and Anne Frank becomes a famous semi-famous literary person and feels like her life was sort of not that interesting, but she keeps dreaming of the other Anne Frank. And
I'm about halfway into the anthology, and that's my favorite story so far. Oh,
thank you so much. Thank you. So I also, I've been blogging. So my website is matthewkressel.net, but I've started a Substack a few months ago called Outer Deep. So it's outerdeep.substack.net. And I've been doing like sort of writing tips and advice there. And I sometimes dabble with 3D art. So I've done some solar punk themed art. You can see one of them behind me. And if you go to my website, matthewkressel.net, I have links to my DeviantArt page. Some of them are like rewilding type things, or turning, you know, a New York City street into a solar punk street, things like that. I find, you know, can be just as inspiring as reading a story. As far as optimistic fiction that I would recommend, I just started reading this book. Is this going to show up? It's called Where It Rains in Color by Denise Crittenden. It's described as a technicolor Afrofuturist fever dream of a book by R.W.W. Green. It is exactly what that describes. It's really great so far. And I don't know if any of you have read Bewilderment by Richard Powers. So it's sort of like I don't want to say alternate history, but it's sort of like history adjacent to ours. So it's close enough to ours where you recognize our world, but it's actually you could say it's like dystopian, but there's something aggressively beautiful and optimistic about it. It's such a profound reflection on our relationship to nature and our relationship to the universe that I found it extremely moving and extremely optimistic at the end, even though it has a powerful ending, let's just say. But yeah, so that's all the stuff I wanted to mention. But yeah, and my socials at Matt Kressel on I'm at Wandering Shop on Mastodon, at Matt Kressel on Twitter, and Matthew Kressel on Facebook, etc. So
excellent. Well, thank all of you. I thank all of you for doing this. This was an incredibly interesting and stimulating conversation.